And you're listening to Brisbane Line on 4ZZZ 102.1 FM, and I'm Elliot Rifkin. Do you know much about our native bush fruits and other foods? Do you know where you can buy bush fruit or how it gets to market? We'll chat about new support being developed for our Indigenous communities, aiding them in getting their produce to domestic and international markets. Joining us is Yasmina Sultanbawa of UQ's ARC Training Center for Uniquely Australian Foods. Welcome, Yasmina.
Oh, thank you, Elliot. Thank you for the opportunity.
No worries. Hey, well, first of all, what is UQ's ARC Training Center?
So the Australian Research Council Training Center is called an Industrial Transformation Training Center for Uniquely Australian Foods, which works in collaborative partnerships with Indigenous communities to convert traditional knowledge to branded products using best practice protocols. So the intellectual property and all that is protected, Elliot. That is what we do in the ARC Training Center, and we look at bush foods as one of the uniquely Australian foods that we study.
What is considered bush food?
Yes, that's an interesting question. So Australian bush fruit is a food that has been used by Indigenous Australians for sustenance for over 65,000 years. It is used for its nutritive value and also for medicinal value. And then if you look at globally, the bush foods would be where Indigenous communities anywhere in the world would be using it as food. So it's usually wild harvested and grown in a sustainable manner.
And this does not include meat, right?
No, you can have bush tupperware. You can have things like kangaroo considered as a bush food.
Okay, all right. Just wanted to clarify that. You're creating a portable chemistry kit for the Indigenous communities. That's what your project pretty much is. So how does that all work, and how did you get involved in that?
Yes, so I've been working with remote Indigenous communities for over 10 years, Elliot. And when I go into communities, we do a lot of sample collection, and there's a lot of information that you can gather on the field. And then we have to transport these samples under, refrigerated conditions, and then we do the analysis in Brisbane. So I work right across Northern Australia, so Northern Territory, the Kimberleys, and Northern Queensland. I realized that there's a lot of information that you can gather on the field if you can have a portable digital chemistry toolkit to understand the quality of the fruit. And then my boss, Dr. Arne Fan, put this equipment together, and we realized how powerful it was when we had Indigenous communities coming for training in our laboratory. And now we are trialing it on the field, and it's just information that can be gathered in a very short time but would really make them empowered to have market access.
What is in your toolkit? And I would suspect that you started it off with it in one way, and it's sort of like grown and evolved.
Yes, and it will grow and evolve further because it just depends on where the community is in the native food value chain. So if you're harvesting, you will have a different set of equipment, because there you would need to understand where the fruit is, what the yield is in terms of, the pile to seed ratio. Now, this is important information that buyers require when they want to buy the product. It can also tell you what the sweetness of the fruit is by a basic measurement, and that also guides you into how easy it is to process the product. And sometimes the fruit is very acidic. You can have the measure the acidity levels by pH. So all that information together, when the buyer comes to these communities to purchase the product, these are some of the basic questions that are asked, and this doesn't have to be done in a food lab. It can be done on the field.
What types of chemicals do you use? Is it just basically a pH kit that people would use for fermenting beer?
So pH could be one measurement kit, but you would also have things like Brix meters that can do the sugar levels. And it sometimes can be just a simple water extraction that you can do, and then you can measure these parameters. And when you look at a fruit, you get the pulp of the fruit, that is the flesh of the fruit, and the seed. And if the weight of the seed, if it's minimal, then it's very attractive because you get a better flesh. And that is what the industry will be looking at, unless you're grinding the whole fruit. So the pulp is the one that we are looking at. And if your seed is very big, then that's not very advantageous. So if you have a smaller seed, then you get a large amount of pulp, and that becomes attractive for product development.
You just said the current method that you're doing for food labs has been, if they do anything, is to bring it down to a metro area, like whether it's Brisbane or Darwin, or possibly, would it be Broome or Perth in the West Coast?
Yes.
Obviously, those areas are very hot, so the damage before it gets to the lab would alter things. So that's why why it's important to do it on the ground.
Exactly. That's a very good point. So when you transport the fruit, you need to have it in refrigerated conditions, or sometimes we ask them to freeze it if it's a long journey, and then that means you can change the characteristics of the fruit. But if you can do on the field, that gives you the real measurement. And what we have noticed is if you, without transportation, you do the field results, and then you also can do some analysis in the lab, which is more sophisticated. But all these results link together and would give you that information. So even though they're basic measurements, they do link well with sophisticated methods that what is known as the phytochemical analysis for health value or some of the other nutritional parameters. These tests are really critical, and it also gives you an understanding of where it is grown. So in terms of prominence and seasonality, all that information gathering is very important for the community, because they will have this information over a long period of time, and then they can gather this information by using iPads and entering this and then connecting that information to the language name, where it is grown, and then to the stories and the prominence. So it gives a really good opportunity for marketing as well for the communities, and each one will have their own story in terms of name and how they process it, how they value add. So the cultural awareness of how they treat that plant material or the native food is completely different from each community. So that also gives them to market it in a different way. Okay. It really targets a premium market, Elliot.
Wow, there's just so much in there that I'd like to ask you, so I will. So one of the things is that you mentioned that it's taking, I guess, basically some of their oral information and putting it into iPads and saving it. And besides that, you're helping to, as a byproduct, save these indigenous languages from going extinct as well.
Yes. So sometimes we market these products using a trade name, which is not the best way. Each community can have their own name for marketing. And by doing that, that language is preserved, because they will start using that language to describe. And then also you can get things like, you know, dancers connected to the food. So when you look at those premium markets and you have those stories, I think that there is a section of the consumer who would be willing to pay that premium price.
Right. And a couple of other things before we move forward, I wanted to backtrack on. You mentioned that in the current way of doing it, you have to get it to a metro area. Now, most people don't realize, because they're living down here in Brisbane, when you're saying a remote area, you mean really remote. There might not even be some roads that are really well to travel, and there might not even be any GPS. Do I have that right?
Yes, it's beautiful, even though it's remote. Mm. Sometimes I go there and I don't want to come into metro, but yes, you're correct. So in terms of testing, yeah, they might not have Wi-Fi and things like that. But if they can do the measurements on the field, that is really great, because if not, the transportation costs and all these other costs add up to the testing. If they have to pay for this to be tested, it will cost them. But in this way, they can get a lot of this information, which would be sufficient to get market access. And then you empower them with the, I always say empowering communities is so important if you want that indigenous native food value chain to be owned, controlled, and led by indigenous communities. It's only through the empowerment. And empowerment in science also brings an entire new generation who will learn about not only the science, but also who are the pollinators of these fruits, because they would go out with their families to gather fruit, and then the storytelling and all that. So you ensure that that information is within that community, and they also have the opportunity to store that information within their communities for future generations.
As you mentioned, for lack of better words, the myths can be used in marketing and share their culture outside of their community with the wider world as well.
Yes, because there's so much to learn, Elliot. I mean, they are sustainable food production systems, even though they're wild harvested. It has lasted for 65,000 years, and there's so much of nutritive value and health value in this product that it should go back into the communities first, but there's a lot to share with the wider community as well.
So what are some of the specific bush fruits that you're working with currently to start off with?
So the one that we've worked for a long time is Terminalia ferdinandiana. The trading name is Kakadu plum, but each of the communities have their own name. And then we've also worked with green plum, and now we are starting to work with Burdigan plum. So these are just common names. These are not language names that communities use. There's a whole lot of other products like Davidson plum and Bunji tamarind and all that are coming into the pipeline, and you can add a lot of value. You know, the end product also should be something that the indigenous indigenous communities can produce. My dream is that entire value chain, from harvesting to processing to value addition to branding and marketing, should be really led by indigenous communities.
The communities that you're currently working with, Kakadu's obviously in Northern Territory. Isn't Burdekin Queensland?
Yes.
So you're working with those communities at the moment, or just Kakadu?
No, we work with North Queensland. We work with the Kakadu Plum and Northern Territory. Kakadu Plum and Green Plum, and then the Kimberleys. We have other fruits in addition to the Kakadu Plum, and Burdekin Plum is, you're correct, North Queensland and Queensland.
What markets are they currently in, and where are you expecting they could potentially go?
So at the moment, there's a huge demand in the domestic market for value addition. Within the communities, also there's consumption, and I think that's very important because you can get fruits going back into communities in a convenient form. And then you have the domestic market where value addition happens sometimes in different sectors like the food, cosmetics, and the nutraceuticals. Huge potential for international markets as well, but then there's a lot of regulations that you need to adhere to before you get into these markets.
Are there any places where someone can get a Kakadu plum now, like in some sort of specialty health food market, or is it basically you just have to go up there?
No, you can. You can get a lot of these products online. We work with enterprise groups, so they are already into production. So, for example, Kayu Superfoods, if you go onto their online database, you can buy all these products that I have been speaking about in a powder form, which is stable, and then you can use it in your smoothies or in your breakfast cereals.
Do you have a link to that online place where people can get some of these foods, and do they go back into the communities, these online groups?
Yes, so I can send you some links, Elliot. These are businesses that are run by indigenous communities. They're indigenous owned.
Okay, that's great. We'll put those links on our program page so that people can help support those communities and also have a taste of some bush fruit. No, that would
fantastic.
Be great.
Thank you.
Yeah. So currently they're wild harvested. Any plans to create some kind of standard agricultural scheme? And if that did happen, because people are people and they can get greedy, so how do you protect the places from getting polluted?
Yes. So at the moment it is wild harvested. And then I told you this is a sustainable production system. So if they want to increase their harvest, some communities are looking at enrichment planting. So that is within that natural landscape, they will add some of these fruit trees. But if you do want to go into that kind of farming model, you need to have the conversation with the communities as to whether that is a pathway that they would like to go into in terms of agriculture, you know. So those discussions you have to have with the communities to see how they want it to be grown. So it's not for us to decide, it is they who should be deciding that.
Another thing is, you mentioned the sweetness tests that you have.
Yes.
Is that what humans want? The more sweet it is, the better chance the fruit's going to sell? Is that why?
Yes, so for example, the green plum, when we go to harvest, it's almost impossible to get samples because it's so delicious. We just take it off. I mean, everybody wants to eat it. The sweeter the fruit, of course, if that is eaten as a fresh fruit, the sweeter, the better. And that is something that the communities also have knowledge. They would know where the sweet trees are. And that will help them when they analyze it as well, you know, when they test it, to understand that that correlates with the knowledge that they already have. But some of these fruits are really not sweet. Some of them are quite tart and acidic. And then you would have a different measurement. But then that product wouldn't be like a table fruit. You would go for further value addition like a powder. And maybe it can be used as a preservative, or it will have some other applications.
Right, because I would suspect that there's a lot of herbs and medicines that aren't being used in the wider community that can be looked at for profit for the indigenous communities as well.
Of course. There's huge potential. So, for example, if they want to do herbs, then we would give them a different type of toolkit, because that would be the moisture and how far it has dried and, you know, at certain point, whether you can prevent it from fungus growing and things like that. So that is also, you know, how stable the product is. Even in terms of sweetness, if it's very sweet, then when you dry, you can have challenges. And then sometimes for drying, you might use a combination of these fruits, you know. The sweeter it is, the harder sometimes it is to remove the moisture and to get it really good dried product. So all that information is important for value addition and product development and where your target market is. And then also it goes back to how long you can store the product, what type of packaging you need to use. So even though they're simple measurements, they're very important information.
In terms of stopping fungus and things like that for the herbs, a lot of times when we buy spices or other powder things, there'll be a desiccated sac in it to keep the moisture out. Mm-hmm. Are those going to be shared up in those communities as well?
Yes, or you can drop the moisture to a level that the microorganisms will not grow. And for that, we would give them what is known as measurement of water activity. So that's the critical amount of water that is required for microorganisms to grow. Then we know that at that particular water activity level, we can control those bugs.
How is packaging going to be determined for the different types of products? And is the packaging going to be done up on the indigenous communities, or are they going to ship their, like, let's say, the green plums elsewhere for packaging?
So sometimes they do get these bulk orders, 4-5 kilogram bags in a particular packaging material, and then further value addition might happen in another processing plant where they might put it into smaller sachets. But some of the communities, they do the packaging on ground as well within their processing plant. But the important thing is, if it's a dry powder, then the type of packaging that you use would be different to, say, if it's a frozen whole fruit.
I guess with powders, you would have those shrink wrap kind of things.
Yeah, a double laminated or a triple laminated product that you don't get moisture coming in, and then it will retain those nutrients and health value. So if you get moisture coming in, then the product can actually grow microorganisms or fungi, and then also you get the degradation of nutritive value. So it's important to understand what packaging is required depending on what the end product qualities are.
Does UQ's ARC Center consult with the communities to help them determine what packaging?
Yes. We do a lot of their testing, and we do a lot of their product development, value addition, and it just depends on what they want us to do. So it is a conversation that we have, a discussion, and then they would come and tell us this is what needs to be done, and then they work with our researchers, and then we ensure that that information goes back to the community. So there, we have 11 PhD students within the training center that are working with communities, and there is a huge amount of information that transferred back into the community once we have got their product. It's kind of a really interesting partnership that forms between the student and the community as well. Depending on what they want, we have those constant discussions and reporting mechanisms so that they can grow their market.
How do they get in touch with you if they've got a product that they think is viable that you might not know of?
I sent you the link for the ARC Training Center earlier. They can contact us through that, and then we can have the conversation.
There's at least 11 indigenous community LGAs, for lack of a better word, here in Queensland alone. Have you guys contacted all of them, or how does that all work?
Yeah, so when we applied for the grant, so I said I've worked in this area for over 10 years. So I already had a lot of communities that I had been working with. So the trust, you know, our relationship has grown over time. And those were the communities that joined us for this grant. And then there are other communities who will join us on the way. And there is kind of a screening process just to see how, whether they have an enterprise, where they are in terms of, you know, what they want to look at. So we have those discussions with them to understand exactly what they want, and then determine whether they would fit into our ARC training center.
The toolkit, how will it be distributed to these indigenous communities? Is it being distributed now? And what kind of tech support do they get in these remote areas?
Oh, good question. So we will have 2 pilot runs in the Northern Territory and in North Queensland. And we will train community members, and they will work very closely with staff to see how the measurements are done. And they will have those discussions, because we will also have reference testing done within our labs. And we will look at those results and compare them, and then see that during different seasons, they will pick these fruits. So there'll be a constant exchange of information till they're really comfortable in using it. And then, you know, how much of sample, how many fruits to take from each tree to sample, all that will be done in a training program, and then we'll be continuously working with them and monitoring them. But they own all that information.
When do you plan to start these pilots, or have they started?
Yes, so we did one pilot training in Northern Territory in April, and then we had another one in June, and then we will move the test kits in August, September. With this lockdown, it might change a little bit, but that's our plan.
Might keep in touch with you to find out how your program is going.
Oh, that would be great, Elliot.
In the last few minutes that we have, where can people learn more about your project and Bush Food? I'll put links up on our program page that you sent us. And is there anything else I haven't asked you that you feel that people should know?
I think to the wider audience that I'm talking to, it would be great if you can purchase product from Indigenous-owned businesses to support them and to make their economic participation much stronger in the native food value chain. That's the only way that we can really generate employment in remote communities.
How would you suggest that they verify that they're indigenously owned?
So when they go online, they will say whether they're indigenously owned or not. That would be one of the ways that they promote their products. Okay. I can also send you some links.
Right, we'll put those links up. Basically, I guess what you're saying is that just because it's an indigenous item, don't assume it's indigenous owned. Just take that extra moment to like just see who owns this company.
Yes, exactly.
Thank you, Yasmina. It's quite interesting and it sounds like a really wonderful project that you've got going on there.
Thank you so much, Elliot, for your time and for giving me the opportunity.
No worries. All right, and we'll be in touch.
Okay, thank you.
That was Yasmina Sultanbawa of UQ's ARC Training Center. We were chatting about new support being developed for our indigenous communities, which is aiding them in getting their bush foods to market.